Alaska Public Media presents Debate for the State. And now your moderator, Lori Townsend.
Good evening, and welcome to the second hour of Alaska Public Broadcasting's Debate for the State. We just completed the debate with candidates for Lieutenant Governor, and now we'll hear from those who want to be governor. I'm Lori Townsend, News Director for Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Tonight's programs are collaborations of all of Alaska Public Broadcasting stations. Our guests are candidates for governor who have registered at least 5% in recent political polls. Republican Sean Parnell has served as governor since 2009 when Governor Sarah Palin stepped down. Mr. Parnell is an attorney. He served in the Alaska legislature for 8 years and then worked for ConocoPhillips. His running mate for lieutenant governor is Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks.
Bill Walker is an independent candidate for governor. Mr. Walker is also an attorney, has been a former mayor of Valdez, and served on the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. He was the project manager for the Alaska Gasline Port Authority. Mr. Walker ran as a Republican for governor in 2010, and this year teamed up with former Democratic candidate Byron Mallott for a non-affiliated ticket. Welcome.
Thank you.
Joining me on our news panel, again, is Alexander Gutierrez, State Capitol Correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network. Thank you, Alexander, for being here. And Ben Matheson is a news reporter for KYUK Public Radio in Bethel. Hello, Ben. Candidates, we're going to start now with the rules for our debate. We have several segments in our program tonight, ranging from your style as governor to health care. Each question will be timed. First, you will see a yellow light letting you know that you have a few more seconds to complete your thoughts, your answers. When you hear this bell, the time is up. I will enforce this as politely as possible. Earlier, we tossed a coin and Mr. Walker won the right to answer the first question. You will have, in this round, you'll have 45 seconds to respond. And we'll start with Ben Matheson.
Mr. Walker, what do you believe that you offer that your opponent does not?
I'd say in a word, leadership. I think leadership is the critical difference between the two of us. I think there's a number of issues facing the state of Alaska. It's evident that leadership has been lacking. And it's one that it's a quality that without leadership at the highest level, we end up finding ourselves in situations we're in right now regarding the fiscal deficit that we're in, issues associated with the Alaska National Guard, high cost of energy, education funding issues. So leadership is absolutely the single biggest distinction between the two of us.
Mr. Parnell, what do you offer that your opponent does not?
Well, I think steady, stable experience and leadership. As I look at Bill Walker right now, who's litigating at Point Thompson and putting at risk 1,000 jobs that we had there this spring, he wants to renegotiate the gas line when we've made historic progress there. I've just got a record of public service in Alaska. I've got a love for our people, and I think what I offer is that steady, consistent leadership rather than changing positions depending on which audience I speak with.
Mr. Parnell, a governor depends on his leadership staff. What will your cabinet look like if reelected? Again, you have 45 seconds to respond. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Alex. We've got a tremendous cabinet right now. We've got very good people in place when it comes to public safety, when it comes to Department of Commerce. We've got some very competent, qualified men and women. And I look for people with integrity. I look for people with a heart for Alaska. I look for people with competence in what they do. That's one of the challenges of becoming a new governor is it does take about a year to a year and a half to get a cabinet up to speed. We have people working right now on Alaskans' behalf who have that heart for service and that competence.
And Mr. Walker, who is leading your transition team and who would we expect to see appointed to your cabinet?
You know, it's exciting to be talking about transition teams. I know we're up in the polls, and so that's exciting, so I get a lot of calls about that. You know, our administration will look like Alaska. We'll have a non-partisan administration. It'll be based upon not what party they belong to. It'll just be the best and brightest Alaskans. It'll look like Alaska, both regionally, ethnically, gender-wise. It will reflect Alaska based upon Alaska, not based upon one political party or another.
And Mr. Walker, could you provide any more specifics?
As far as individuals, You know, I haven't. I have individuals in mind at this point. There's some that have approached me, but I'm a little bit old-fashioned when it comes to sort of getting too far ahead on the, we've got 6 days left in this race, and all of our focus is on those 6 days. So whoever he or she may be in a particular position, but I have said, you know, those that are currently in those positions doesn't necessarily mean that they won't be, you know, when I'm governor, because, you know, again, I'm looking for the best and the brightest, and if an individual has served under Governor Parnell, that is certainly not a disincentive for them to stay on. So there may be some that wouldn't be surprised that will stay on in the administration because they're very good.
This fall, federal investigators found deeply troubling problems within the leadership of the Alaska National Guard. Alexander will have a first question about the future of the Guard. Gentlemen, you'll have 1 minute to respond to questions in this segment.
Mr. Parnell, moving forward, do you believe the governor should have a more personal role in responding to complaints from whistleblowers?
As governor, I had a very personal role in responding, as did my chief of staff and the staff in my office. I responded directly. We took it to the FBI. National Guard Bureau came in 2011, did an inspection. Senator Begich's office did the same and found the same thing I did. The bottom line is, going forward, we need to move forward with the National Guard Bureau's roadmap on the investigation that I called in and had done. They already have teams in place at the armory there, working with enlisted members and officers to correct the issues that were identified in the National Guard Bureau's deep dive. Additionally, we've completed now interviews for a new adjutant general. That's very important to get a new adjutant general in place. And the answer is, moving forward, we need to honor our Guard members, respect and work to make sure that victims get the support they need, and make sure that perpetrators are penalized, and above all, honor every Guard member there.
And Mr. Parnell, when do you believe it's appropriate for the governor to meet directly with whistleblowers, and how often?
You know, that really is a case-by-case basis, and the whistleblowers need to have an avenue, as they have had in my office, to make sure that they get the attention they need. With 14 departments, they need an avenue, and they have that both in the governor's office as well as through their own different chains of command.
And Mr. Walker, how personally involved do you believe a governor should be when conversing with whistleblowers and responding to their complaints?
Well, first let me say, I would never consider chaplains as whistleblowers. Chaplains are ordained priests that are in a unique position in the Guard. So I've never characterized when the chaplains came to Governor Parnell. If they came to Governor Walker, chaplains, I would act immediately. I would ask for an independent investigation. I would not go back through the sort of the rank and file that the chaplains went around to get to my office. I would go immediately and have an investigation, an independent investigation. I don't think it's any stronger than that. And, you know, the whistleblower, typically it's involved something in their own situation. This was not the case. These individuals risked their military career in going around the chain of command and going to the governor's office. And so I've never considered them in that situation to be whistleblowers. I think they're honorable individuals. My highest priorities is the victims. If someone comes to me and says that someone is a victim of a horrific activity, I will take immediate action and not go back to the chain of command.
Mr. Walker, do you believe the Alaska legislature should play a role in reforming or addressing concerns in the Guard?
You know, I think there can be a role for the legislature, but I think that the governor is the commander-in-chief of the Guard, of the Alaska National Guard, and I plan to fulfill that role aggressively and honorably with the Guard. So, you know, involving the legislature at this point, I think that more than it is now, maybe as a result of lack of leadership. So I'm very comfortable in the role of the governor has with the National Guard as commander-in-chief.
There's been a call for an investigation led by the legislature to look into the Guard. Is that something you'd support?
I would support a special prosecutor. I think a special prosecutor should be appointed to go in and find out who knew what, when, and how have we gotten to the bottom of this. You know, bringing in federal agencies to do investigation was one thing, but I think a special prosecutor is very appropriate.
Mr. Parnell, should the Alaska legislature play a role in this?
You know, before I answer that question, I'm going to address Mr. Walker's assertion that I did not act immediately and just call it what it is. It's a bald-faced lie, and I will not allow you to continue to say that. And the bottom line is, when a victim comes to my office, I believe them, and I move immediately yes, with the chain of command to check, to make sure that they have moved that case to the police department. But beyond that, to make sure that other allegations that are appropriate and get referred to the FBI, as I did in 2010. There were about five separate investigations between 2010 and 2013 that all found exactly what I did, that the processes were in place. It was me who called in 2014 for that deep dive look by the National Guard Bureau. The legislature's role you asked about, bottom line is that National Guard Bureau report said there is a role for updating our National Guard statutes. That's where the legislature's role really is in this, is perhaps considering UCMJ, Code of Military Justice provisions, or other updates to our National Guard laws.
Do they have the expertise and do they have the knowledge to be able to make some of those decisions and assist in that?
Well, of course, that's part of what legislators do, is they call on experts. So, for example, right now, because of the recommendation by the National Guard Bureau to update the statutes, I've asked our Department of Law and the National Guard Staff Judge Advocate Corps and the National Guard Bureau to help us with that. And then when we have a proposal, we put it in front of the legislature. The legislature calls upon those experts as well as their own in military justice and in the legal arena to make those decisions. That's what legislators do. They get the best advice they can. They make the decision and move.
All right, let's move now to a completely different topic, oil prices, which are well below the forecast used to pass this year's state budget. In fact, today the price of a barrel of Alaska North Slope crude was $82.77. Our next segment will be on funding Alaska's future. Our first question is from Ben to Mr. Walker. Candidates, please keep your responses to 1 minute.
Mr. Walker, short of a dramatic increase in new production, how would you raise new revenues for the state?
You know, a number of things we need to do. But before we do that, I do have to respond back to the governor, if you don't mind. You know, that is not a lie. You need to review the interview you did with Channel 2 when you said the first thing you did is you went back to General Cactus. That rather than do an investigation, you went back to General Cactus. You always say you did something. You did something. You did the wrong thing. So that's not a lie, and the evidence is in the record. And when you release the 8,000 emails, maybe that'll be further emphasis of the truth in this matter. Oil prices. We've had oil prices decline in the past. We need to be ready to. We need to grow our economy. We need more oil, and we need to do that with more oil companies on the North Slope. I'm a big proponent of that. You know, we have to grow our way out of this. We can't cut our way out of this. You can't cut our way into prosperity. I've always said that. But we do have to have a sustainable budget. There's no question about that, and I think we'll probably get into that a bit later. But we have got to develop our resources responsibly. We're a resource state. 90% of our income comes from resources. So we've got to grow our resources, make sure we have more companies come to Alaska, not fewer.
If the North Slope is an aging and declining oil field and production does decline, how do you find revenue if not through increasing production or new taxes?
Well, I don't think you can tax your way into prosperity either. I think you need to grow it. I think we need to get more companies coming for more oil. The ones we have here are very good. I'm glad we have them. We need the 50 or 60 companies to come. There's plenty of oil on the North Slope. We don't have any big, huge, you know, elephants anymore on the North Slope. We need those smaller fields we need to get developed.
Mr. Parnell, short of a dramatic increase in oil production, how do we find new revenue for the state?
Well, I think we actually focused on that with SB 21. That's another place where Bill Walker and I differ. I sponsored and moved forward SB 21, the More Alaska Production Act. Since then, at this $82 a barrel, we're actually seeing more revenue than we would have under ACES. So bottom line is we actually have more revenue now, but beyond that, we have more production. We were having a 6% to 8% production decline before the More Alaska Production Act was put into place. On the North Slope now, there are more jobs available than there have been recently. I just sat next to a young man on an airplane going to Kenai who was coming back from his job on the North Slope, and the folks there said they'd been working there for 30 years and never seen it so busy. The bottom line is, with new production, we will get new revenue. But beyond that, we've got to cut spending. And so that's the combination of new revenue, cut spending, and manage our savings well.
Will the state in the future be able to be funded 90% general fund by oil taxes?
Well, we are now. I mean, between taxes and royalties, that's what funds us right now.
Going 5, 10, 15 years down the road, is 90% possible, or is there new taxes?
Well, by that time, I anticipate we're going to have a gas line feeding $2 to $3 billion worth of revenue beyond. I mean, that's the next step for revenue, is getting a gas line built. But I look to the North Sea as an example. So in Aberdeen, Scotland, when they changed their tax code just a couple of years back to drive new investment to the North Sea, billions of dollars came flooding back in. Aberdeen, Scotland had less than 1% unemployment, and there was new production coming. And that's probably a 3-year to 5-year turnaround. That's what their experience was. If we get that kind of turnaround, that's going to be positive for Alaska. Right now, we're already seeing the beginning of that economic growth starting in Alaska. We need to continue this path.
With oil at $80, $82 a barrel, what does that tell producers who want to make those investments but are looking at a price that doesn't look so attractive right now?
Well, different than maybe you and me when we are making some short-term spending decisions, they have a 30-year, 40-year time horizon for an investment. That's why it was so important to get a competitive tax regime so that across time, when they go spend $50 or $60 million to explore, you know, drill one or two or three exploration wells, and then they spend $1 billion for an investment in a field, they assume that they're going to get a return on that across 30 years. So they look at the tax regime, not just at today's low prices, but it's a commodity that goes up and down. And Alaska is now competitive for that investment where we were not before.
And Mr. Parnell, how does the upcoming budget differ from the current one? Will we see greater cuts or larger draws on our budget reserves? Again, the time limit is 1 minute.
Thank you. Thanks, Alex. You know, we're going to keep spending less. And in my 5 years as governor, when we had a bipartisan Senate majority, the kind of unity majority of 2010 and 2011, spending ramped up. And I exercised the veto pen at record levels. I cut $300 million from the 2010 legislative budget, $400 million from the 2011 budget. And then the last 2 years, the people sent a more fiscally conservative legislature, and we cut spending at record levels. No other governor has cut $1 billion and $1.1 billion respectively from the budget. And we did it by addressing this year with legislators, by addressing the single biggest cost driver in the operating budget. So I intend to address those big cost drivers, but also require the agencies to absorb salary increases, for example, and create efficiencies within the agencies that drive more spending down.
And Mr. Parnell, could you provide more specifics on where we should see cuts to our upcoming budget?
Yeah. I can't because we're working on the budget now, but in terms of the direction, I can give you some direction. And it's consistent with where I've been the last 5 years. I will propose a budget that's hundreds of millions of dollars below where we are today. That will include both capital and operating cuts. And I go after the big drivers first. And so, again, it was the unfunded pension liability. We have the opportunity there to do some more good work and make some savings there. We have the opportunity in each of the agencies as well to find savings. And that's where we intend to go.
And Mr. Walker, could you please describe your spending plan?
We have to have a sustainable budget. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, I'm interested in what the governor says about working on the budget because that's the one that I'm going to inherit, and I'll have 15 days in which to do something with it once I'm in office on December 1st. You know, what we have to do is obviously we have to look at it at both operating and spending. You have to make sure we have our priorities in with our education, our public safety, and our health provided. But after that, we need to look at the capital side as well as the operating side. Operating side, I would certainly look at least 5% out of in the department as far as efficiencies, that look in each department for with them on the efficiencies in that. On the capital side, my goodness, the studies that we are doing, we have got to stop studying some stuff. I mean, we have been studying the studies of the studies for far too long. It's time we decide what can we build, what do we need to be building, and build it, and what we don't, we need to stop studying. We have hundreds of millions of dollars in studies that just continue to go on and on and on. So we need to look at that. That's in the someone's in the capital side, someone's in the operating side, but we have to have a sustainable budget and a budget plan of going, you know, as far as what point we're going to have a sustainable budget. Because without that, we're a risky place to do business in as far as large companies coming to Alaska, looking at, you know, the currently we're in a deficit of $7 million a day is what we're draining our savings account at. That can last about 5 years, and then those savings are gone.
Both of you identify as fiscal conservatives. Mr. Walker, is there one state department that you think has the most government waste and the most opportunity for savings?
Well, I'd probably look at I'd start with DNR. DNR seems to have grown exponentially over the years, and I'm not sure that the work that we're doing in DNR is warrants that. So I'd take a serious look at DNR, and also I look at the AGDC, the gas line organization. We have a president of that makes about $600,000 a year, based upon when you add in all of his benefits and packages, et cetera. I think we have some really high wages. I mean, that are way out of line in some of our, for someone, an employee to be getting $600,000 a year, seems to be, we need to look at that. If we have people making that kind of money, my goodness, that's pretty low hanging fruit for me.
What inside DNR might be opportunities to cut?
Well, I think sometimes on the regulatory side, some departments are doing something similar that other departments are doing as well. Let's make sure that you know, if we're having, you know, three identical activities in three separate departments, there's a way that we can consolidate those in such a way that we only do it one time rather than three times.
And Mr. Parnell, is there one state department that you think has the most opportunity for savings?
You know, one of the interesting things about what Bill just mentioned with DNR is that I put some more people in DNR to make sure that the permits that were backlogged for years could actually be addressed, so our people and our companies could have their applications processed timely instead of waiting multiple years. You mentioned, is there one department? Actually, the next biggest cost driver in our state's budget is Medicaid, and I last year tasked the Medicaid Review Advisory Group with coming up with recommendations to help us make Medicaid sustainable. If it's not sustainable, it's not going to be there for the individuals who need it. We've added over 25,000 people to the Medicaid rolls since I've been governor, and the program has to be sustainable because people need it. And the Medicaid Review Advisory Group's, one of their primary missions is to identify a way to bend that cost curve on Medicaid, because that is one of the largest growing areas.
How large of a savings potential is there in changing the way we do Medicaid?
Well, Medicaid increases, depending on the year, it goes up by $17 to $80 million, depending upon the year and the assumptions that are made. So, for instance, this year we went after the biggest cost driver in the budget, and that was the unfunded pension liability. That was increasing at $70 to $80 million a year, and we knocked that down substantially by paying down the debt. Medicaid itself, again, depending on the year, goes up $17 to $50 million usually, but it's gone even higher at times.
And Mr. Parnell, with a 90-day session to cover all of these big issues, legislation on major topics often moves quickly. Would you commit to holding weekly press availabilities in the future to meet with the press?
You know, I don't remember ever turning down a press interview this last session, and I'm happy to do those. I held press availabilities. I held probably five or six throughout the session, and I took individual interviews, including yourself, through the session. So, always open to those interviews and have been.
Mm-hmm. But Mr. Parnell, you're not interested in a more regular weekly open format?
No, I mean, not necessarily committing to it, no. I mean, there's travel involved in being governor as well, and we respond daily to press requests. Every day there are 3 to 5 press requests that we're responding to. Mm-hmm. So it is about being open and available on a daily basis, not committing to a weekly press availability.
And Mr. Walker, would you commit to regular press availabilities?
No, I would. I think that's been lacking. I think there should be regular opportunities for the press and also the public. I mean, it's not just the press. The press is a spokesperson, or not the listening person, I guess, for the public. So I would agree to that. I think that's appropriate.
All right. If you're just tuning in and just joining us, our thanks to you for tuning in tonight for Debate for the State for Governor. In this section, candidates will be able to ask each other a question. Please keep your questions succinct to about 20 seconds. Responses will be held to 1 minute, and there will be a 30-second rebuttal if you so decide that you'd like to have that. Mr. Parnell, you may ask the first question of Mr. Walker.
Thank you. I think we've asked each other questions in the last many debates, but Bill, you've been running for governor for about 5 years now since you first announced, and you've had some time to think through things, and as I think about a budget plan, I'd like to know, when it comes to education, K-12 education, will you spend more on education or spend less, you know, in the next year?
That'll be dependent on the revenues that we have. I would like to have, I'd like to be able to say that we could have education fully funded. And in the questionnaires that I've done as well, I said that I would look at educational funding based upon the amount of funds we have available. And, you know, we have to be realistic about that. So I don't think there's any one thing that you can guarantee one way or the other until you look at the fiscal side. So that's what we have to do. We have to look at how much money we have and address that appropriately.
Would you like 30 seconds to respond?
I would, because that's been a sore spot with me, is that I believe Bill's position has changed depending upon the audience he talks to. So in Juneau, in a debate, I asked whether his 16% across the board reduction applied to education, and he said everything's on the table. But in front of Great Alaska Schools, the parent group here in Anchorage, he said he would personally introduce legislation to raise the BSA and add an inflation factor. That adds hundreds of millions of dollars. So I'm still confused whether you will spend more or spend less.
Let's get some clarity on that 16%.
Yeah, I've always added the clarification based upon funding availability. I mean, you always quote half of my quote, and you don't always do the entire statement. So I've always, everything I've said about funding, I've said based upon if we have a sufficient funding available. We don't know that, and we won't know that until we're in office. As Lieutenant Governor candidate Dan Sullivan said, until you're in office, until you actually see what's there, it's hard to make those commitments. I always have to put in that caveat, which I always do, that based upon funding availability, absolutely.
All right, Mr. Walker, it's your opportunity now to ask Mr. Parnell a question. Again, please keep your question succinct, about 20 seconds or so, and you have 1 minute to respond.
Okay. Governor Parnell, you have said you are sort of the open and transparent governor, although it certainly appears that that's not the case in your actions. You have seen on thousands of emails from the National Guard, you have failed, of the 8,000, you've released about two of them. On the study of the price of gas to Fairbanks and the trucking operation, that cost to Fairbanks is to be released one day after the election on November 5th. You know, the air quality plan for Fairbanks at your request has been delayed until after the election. You know, it just goes on and on about the health care report. What is it you don't want Alaska to know before the election?
You know, our administration's been one of the most open and transparent administrations of all time. In fact, I can't think of any other administration that has released tens of thousands of emails and records across our time. When it comes to the specific emails that you're talking about that are related to the National Guard, it is clear that my job in releasing those emails, and obviously I've delegated that to folks in my office rather than me trying to work through the amount of papers there, but first job is protect the victims and their statements in there so they're not re-victimized. Second job is make sure that anything you release doesn't jeopardize prosecutions of wrongdoers. And thirdly, the Attorney General is working with, I believe, this network and another news organization to get those released, and a log has been released of all the documents. And an ask has been made to prioritize what documents you want first. So bottom line is there's already a process in place to move it.
30 seconds to respond.
You know,
to
even the status of where we are on the gas line project, which Alaskans are so anxious to know about, the legislators have to sign a confidentiality agreement in order to be briefed on that project. So it doesn't seem to stop. It seems every time we turn around, it's a behind-the-scenes kind of deals. And, you know, that's just not what Alaska's about. It's their resources, and I think people should know what's going on.
He introduced a new topic in the rebuttal. That was the gas line and confidentiality there, and I'd like a chance to address that as well.
You can address that. You also have an opportunity to ask another question if you would like.
Okay, so you're going to cut off that discussion.
You can address, then. No, you can go ahead, and you've got 30 seconds to respond.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Bill Walker asserted that the gas line process is so confidential, and yet it is the most open and transparent process there is. We came to the legislature with the independent experts analysis. We came to them with the heads of agreement, the guidance documents that guide every internal discussion in pre-feed right now, offtakes for Alaskans, local hire, local buy. Bottom line is the legislature approved this path on a 52-8 margin. 12 to 14 months from now, everything that's been done comes into the light of day again. You cannot negotiate with companies with their proprietary information without being able to keep that confidential. But everything else, the legislature has access to, and the people as well. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Parnell, you can ask a second question of Mr. Walker. You'll also have an opportunity. please keep your questions succinct and keep them to one topic.
You bet. Bill, you fought SB 21 every step of the way, and now that the state is bringing in about $200 million more dollars right now than your position would have given us under ACES, given all the new jobs and investment, will you admit tonight that your opposition to SB 21 was misplaced?
No, it's not misplaced. You know, it's hard to celebrate low oil prices, and I know that's what you do with by saying it's working. You know, you need a number of years to see if it is working. Does it bring new companies to Alaska? Does it put more oil in the pipeline? Does it create the long-term scenario? So to take a snapshot in time and sort of celebrate low oil prices and say, you know, it's designed to bring in more money at low prices, but it's hard to celebrate that. So I would still, because I like the incentives. I like the incentives on the front end. You know, Norway has a much higher tax rate than Alaska, but they incentivize at the low end, and they have 50 or 60 companies. So I'm all about bringing more, not just more on the pipeline, that's critical, but also more companies to Alaska for more opportunities. So I celebrate the large three we have, but we need more companies, and I don't think Senate Bill 21 does that. But I have made the commitment that I will not turn that dial. We spent a lot of time arguing over the oil taxes, as you well know. I will not change that. I'll honor the wishes of the voters, but I'll watch it. I'll make sure that Alaska knows, is it working on the long-term basis, not a snapshot in time, just, you know, 6 days before an election, but long-term.
30 seconds, Mr. Parnell.
This is really about quality of decision-making here, and based on all your measures, SB 21 is working. New revenue that we wouldn't have had before, new investment, billions of dollars, new companies. Kalis on the North Slope, Hillcorp on the North Slope. I met 2 months ago with 18 independent companies who are focused on working in this state. We've got a lot of good companies. In fact, today there's a positive announcement by Brooks Range Petroleum, which was made possible by SB 21 and the new investors that came in there as well. So by every measure you've used, so far SB 21 is working, and yet you still think it was a bad idea.
Way too soon. Kalis has actually bought out Pioneer, so it's not really a new company.
Mr. Walker, you do have an opportunity to ask a second question of Mr. Parnell. Please try to keep it succinct into one topic.
Okay. Mr. Parnell, you have stated that about Pebble Mine. What, do you support it? Do you not support it?
What I've said is that a governor is precluded from supporting or opposing a large mine project because my person, the DNR commissioner, is the judge and jury of any permit application that comes in. So, for example, you have the luxury of taking a position on Pebble Mine when I don't, because the permitting process has to be clear. It would be like an Alaskan coming into a courtroom with a judge who's already predetermined your case. The governor is in that role because his DNR commissioner is that judge and is my representative. And so I cannot take a position except to make sure that the permitting process works for everyone and make sure that the permitting process has clear and consistent rules.
30 seconds.
Well, Governor, you seem to take different positions on different projects. And you sort of hide behind the regulatory process on the Pebble Mine because that's not a popular project. But on the gas line, you're out in front. You run ads on your campaign on it. So you do pick projects that are popular. You're out in front. You're the leader, so to speak, or try to appear to be. But on those that are not, that are controversial, you fall back. So I'm never quite sure where you are. You seem to change your position on one versus the other.
Alaska families pay some of the highest rates in the world for health care. In our next section, we'd like to know how you would address that. Alexandra has our first question for Mr. Parnell.
Mr. Parnell, you said that a large section of Alaska's population needs better access to health care. Other Republican governors have adapted a form of broader Medicaid coverage to fit their needs. Can you explain the difficulty in finding an Alaska version of Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, the difficulty is, How do we do it in a smart way that provides that access that people need, that 10 to 14,000 people need? We're speaking about single able-bodied adults who live at the poverty level or below. And the question is, how do we provide them that kind of access? So I declined Medicaid expansion, but I said I'm open to a better way. And in this case, We currently pay about $11,000 per person per year for Medicaid. To expand requires taxpayer dollars at $44,000 per person annually. I think there's a better way. And I've asked the Medicaid Review Advisory Group to come up with solutions on how we might address that.
Mr. Walker, you said you plan to expand Medicaid in Alaska if you're elected. Is the federal program as it stands appropriate for Alaska's needs? And if so, how would you change it?
It's absolutely appropriate. You know, expanding Medicaid, I will follow the other Republican governors have done the exact same thing. Governor Christie is one. We should accept it's federally funded, 100% paid for. We pay our taxes. It goes to that program. 40,000 Alaskans don't have health care coverage now because Governor Parnell has chosen not to allow them to have. He has not accepted the expanded Medicaid. Over half the states have. You know, it creates additional jobs in our state. I attended that hearing today of the committee that the governor spoke to. It was very passionate testimony about those that are lacking health care. That the result of that committee's report will be out sometime after the election, later this month, is what they said. I will absolutely accept expanded Medicaid to help. I cannot say no to 40,000 Alaskans who do not have health care coverage now because of Governor Parnell's partisan decision.
Mr. Walker, this year a bill that would restrict Medicaid reimbursements for abortion was signed into law. In some other states, there's been laws passed that would create mandatory waiting periods for women seeking abortions and can regulate providers in such a way that clinics can be shut down. Mr. Walker, is there legislation you would support that would restrict access to abortion?
You know, I have to look at each piece of legislation when it comes across my desk. You know, I am a pro-life individual, and that's been my long stance, but I can't predetermine how I'm going to handle any bill until I actually see it comes across my desk. I will confer with my attorney general, whoever she or he may be. I'll confer with my cabinet. I'll confer with Byron Mallott, my lieutenant governor, and then I'll make that decision on my own based upon what I think is the right thing to do.
Can you give your stance on mandatory waiting periods?
You know, I'll look at that. I'll look at the Senate waiting periods. I'll look at that.
And you can't say whether you support it or not today?
No.
Okay. And laws that would restrict access to clinics that can be shut down, rules that require certain requirements for clinics?
You know, I'll look at those individually, and I have not at this point looked at those, but I will look at those individually and make my decision based upon the information that's available at the time.
Mr. Parnell, would you support mandatory waiting periods or any rules that may require providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital level for abortions?
You know, honestly, I haven't thought about those particular provisions, but I can tell you that Alaskans are clear that I'm a pro-life governor. This year I signed a law that defines medical necessity for public funding of abortions. The Alaska Supreme Court has said that for public funding of abortions that the legislature can decide what is medically necessary and that public funds can be put towards. So I have and will continue to look for ways to limit public funding of abortions, but the specific examples you've given, I've not even
heard or considered. Mandatory waiting periods? It's a common one?
Again, I haven't considered it, but but generally I would be supportive, yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll move now to some questions about rural Alaska, where communities face unique challenges for public safety, resource management, and governance. We'd like to know some of your plans for addressing several rural needs, beginning with public safety. Ben Matheson has our first question for Mr. Walker. Response time is 1 minute.
Mr. Walker, this past month, after an apparent double murder in Shagluck, community members, in the absence of any local law enforcement, held the suspect for 14 hours before troopers could arrive. What are your plans for ensuring that law enforcement in rural Alaska is adequate?
Well, we need to make sure it's adequately staffed. I like the idea that the village public safety officer being armed at the option of the, I know that was some legislation that went through this year, and I think that's a good step. But there has been the comparison drawn. If there's a moose taken out of season, there seems to be a response pretty quick, and some of these others there's not. We need to find out why is that. Do we not have enough staff? Are they not distributed appropriately around the state? We need to be able to respond quicker. I remember the facts of that case, and it was a very horrific situation that there needs to be an ability to respond quicker.
Mr. Parnell, what needs to change to have a more full presence of law enforcement in rural Alaska?
I mean, public safety and the situation you've identified is all too common in rural Alaska, and that's why I have more than doubled the number of funded positions for village public safety officers. And but let's come back to the specific instance you spoke to. I mean, that was a tragic situation where troopers were actually on the LifeMet flight and would have been there sooner had that LifeMet flight continued on. The bottom line is we need to get troopers and VPSOs into those communities. I've made it a high priority of my administration to add village public safety officers. We also need a federal government that's going to step up and fund its public safety priorities in rural Alaska as well when it comes to the VPOs and the TPOs. So there are a number of things we can do, but again, we're working with the tribes to not only fund more positions, but we need more VPSOs trained. And I supported and signed the bill that allows VPSOs to be armed as well. I think that's a very important piece.
Do you have a target number of VPSOs that you'd like to fund in the next few years?
Well, I said that I would work to fund a VPSO for every community that wants one. And I've proposed 15 new village public safety officers every year in my budget. At this point, though, we have, I believe, about 20 more positions than we have VPSOs, and we're working to fill those. The other piece that I've worked on is to make sure that VPSOs and troopers have housing in rural communities so that they can spend more time there when that is not their permanent duty post.
Mr. Parnell, is there ever a situation where a tribal court should have jurisdiction over a non-tribal member?
Yes, actually, the courts have already spoken to that in a couple instances. But one of the ways that I think we can bring more culturally relevant remedies to the table and perhaps more effective sentencing is to include tribal courts in, for instance, alcohol cases and in first-time domestic violence cases. Those are cases where I tasked my attorney general to go negotiate those agreements with tribal entities like Tanana Chiefs, for example, or like the community in Cake. We are waiting on a signed agreement to come back from those tribal entities. And so I think tribal courts can play a significant role, not just in foster care type cases or in adoption type cases, but they can play a role in alcohol and DV cases as well.
And Mr. Walker, when should tribal courts have a role over non-tribal members, specifically with situations with more criminal aspects like alcohol or domestic violence cases?
Well, you know, when I was in Bethel, actually, I spent some time there looking at the tribal court justice opportunity there and met with a local attorney that is very passionate about that and heard example after example of how that has been effective and some of the process that's used. So I am very supportive, and I know that in Prince Wales Island in Klawak, they also have used that in the past as well. So it's something that I am very anxious to see expanded and developed and find that that point, that jurisdictional point that is most effective for the residents in that area.
Mr. Walker, many rural Alaska communities are seeing the effects of black tar heroin, prescription painkillers, methamphetamines. What sort of tools and support do local VPSOs from that law enforcement perspective, need to effectively combat that?
Well, I am a big supporter of drug dogs. I think that they've been very effective as far as to locate that on its way in. And I know we have some areas that have them. I think we need to have them more. I know they're fairly expensive to train to get them, but once they're into the system, I think it's been very, very effective around the state. So I would. That's been just horrific in some of the rural areas and also in the urban areas. It's not limited to rural. It's also urban areas as well. But I think the drug dogs would be an excellent step.
Mr. Parnell, hard drugs in Alaska's villages, what can local law enforcement do?
Well, clearly more enforcement tools like drug dogs. I mean, whether it's coming in on the Alaska Marine Highway System on the ferries or whether it's coming in through the airports or through general aviation, we have opportunity there to increase enforcement. But there's also the community element. There's also VPSOs having a community that's engaged. And I think about the Alakanuk model, which is a wellness program where the community is engaged in these issues as well. And if you get a VPSO combined with community support, which that community support, that Alakanuk model, is something that I help to fund through my budget, if you have the VPSO enforcement piece and you have the community support, you're going to have a much better chance at stopping that trade.
And sticking with rural Alaska, this past summer, the Yukon and Kuskokwim king salmon fisheries were largely shut down, while out in the Bering Sea, the pollock fleet managed to catch its quota and some 14,000 king salmon as bycatch in the process. Is that burden of conservation equitably distributed at this point?
No, it's absolutely not. And in fact, Commissioner Cora Campbell of the Department of Fish and Game, as a member of the North Pacific Council, has already worked to get bycatch limits in place so that that burden of conservation is shared not only by those in the direct fisheries and the rivers that you mentioned, but also by the trawl fleet, for example. So that's another huge element. But there's also another issue, and that is federal management of our waters. You know, when the federal government managed the Kuskokwim this year, they also managed, you know, our people got about 60 fish. And so we've got to have some more consultation, coordination together, not only with tribal members, but we've also got to get the federal government on the same page with us for that in-river management as well.
Would you support inter-tribal fish commissions to have some of those tribal members directly engaged in management?
Well, certainly that depends upon the structure of what the Intertribal Commission would look like and the powers of that commission, but certainly there's room for more consultation and more cooperation there.
Mr. Walker, is that burden of conservation being shared between the Bering Sea Trawl Fleet and in-river users?
No, and I spent time in both in Kodiak and also in Alaska sort of looking at the trawl fleet and sort of looking at the processing and see what goes on out there. You know, I sat through a food security session at AFN a year ago and listened to a lady talk about, you know, trying to catching a king salmon on the Yukon River and the laws she would violate if her grandson was hungry. We need to aggressively go after that issue and find out, you know, and find ways that, and I attended a portion of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting and listened to some of the testimony about the bycatch issue. And that's a big, big issue. I know there's steps being taken, but, you know, whether it's a bycatch quota, which some are talking about that, we have to address that. And frustrating is that the fish, the bycatch fish actually goes to Seattle rather than here in Alaska. And I think that's where I would start to make sure that at least the bycatch fish that's caught at least stays in Alaska. I mean, my goodness, it shouldn't be leaving the state and going down south to Seattle. So bycatch is a big, big issue, and I would be very aggressive about that.
Intertribal Fish Commission in a few seconds, is that something you support?
I think it's something I would look at. You bet I would. I like to have local folks involved in things that impact their life. So if the structure was appropriate, I would absolutely look at it. You bet.
Alexander.
And I believe we have some extra time.
We do.
So changing the subject and going back to judiciary issues, Mr. Parnell, this past session a constitutional amendment was offered that would change the makeup of the Judicial Council. Some advocates for that measure argued that it was necessary to combat an activist court. Do you believe that the state of Alaska has an activist court, and do you believe there should be changes to the way judges are selected?
So yes, at times I can point to specific decisions and speak to an activist court, but let me speak to the Judicial Council, because that's a hugely important function. The Judicial Council screens people who are applying to be judge, and they send through a number of candidates to the governor for potential appointment. Now, I have taken that role of the governor very seriously, and I've actually interviewed every candidate that the Judicial Council has put forward to me before making a selection. For the most part, the Judicial Council has done a very good job at sending highly qualified people, and I've picked, you know, from Republicans, Democrats, nonpartisans, you name it, they're all represented, they're all high quality. But there have been moments where the public members of the Judicial Council have been overruled, and that is not the tradition. So in other words, on a tie vote, the Chief Justice, typically, this is how Dana Fabe used to do it, she would say that she would side with the public members for that appointment and whether or not they get moved on. I think that principle needs to be returned, but that could be a practice of the existing Judicial Council.
Without necessarily a constitutional amendment to change it.
Correct, but I can tell you if the practice continues and the frustration continues to build on the part of the public with the Judicial Council appearing to manipulate judges through, if that perception builds, you can expect the public to want more change. So I think there's opportunity for the Judicial Council to change that pattern. I think it's something that I have called to the attention of a former Chief Justice, after he was no longer in that position. But I think that's something that we need to be careful of. Yeah.
And Mr. Walker, do you believe that we have an activist court? And do you believe that there should be a change to the Judicial Council via a constitutional amendment?
No, I don't believe. I do not believe we have an activist court. And I'm very. My job is to defend the Constitution, so I'd be concerned about any modification that would change that process. You know, the Judicial Council has been there. It's been there in a long time. It has worked. I know there's been some frustration back and forth with different governors. I don't see a particular problem with the council at this point, and so I don't. You know, given where we are, the issues on my plate coming into office, that's not an area I'm going to expend an awful lot of time, because we need to get our financial situation in order and come up with a sustainable budget. So that's not where I'm going to spend my time on the judicial process of how the judges are selected, as far as who comes to me, that process. I'll leave that alone.
But the constitutional amendment that was offered this year nearly did make it through the Senate. If it ended up on your desk, what would you do with it?
I will treat it like every other piece. I will look at it. I'll read it. I'll get my advice from my lieutenant governor, and I'll make a decision when I see it. I just can't sit here and say how I'm going to rule on a particular piece of legislation I've not seen.
Alex, I have to jump in and just say a constitutional amendment would not make it to a governor's desk. It would go directly from legislators to the people for a vote.
I'd like to jump back to some rural Alaska issues again, the issue of drugs in rural Alaska. If Alaskans vote to legalize marijuana, would you support legislation to allow local governments to ban possession and use, much in the same way that communities can now ban through alcohol through local option laws? Could you please limit your answer to 30 seconds?
Yes. I'm a big proponent of communities determining their own course, and so, of course, I'd look favorably upon legislation like that.
Mr. Walker.
I would. I come from local government. I believe the purest form of government is local government, so I think that giving them the opportunity, I think that's actually built in now, so I absolutely would make sure that they have the opportunity to waive and decline if that's their choice.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We are getting close to the end of the hour. Alexandra has a couple of closing questions for both candidates.
Mr. Parnell, you may have you may be delivering another State of the State address to the legislature and the rest of Alaska in January if reelected. What do you think the most important part of that speech will be?
Thank you. You know, State of the State speech is a very important communication from a governor. It sets the vision forward for the public at the legislature in a way that is not, you're not able to communicate it in quite that way at any other time. And for me, the State of the State this year would contain two key elements. One is get the gas line built, and it's calling the legislature in its role to help with that. Secondly, it's going to be about increasing career technical education opportunities for our kids. It's going to be about the proposal I made to blow the doors open on career technical education. What does that look like? It looks like when a young person gets a diploma from high school, I want them to also be able to have a chance to get a trade or a certificate, a skill set. Additionally, if they want to do something else, they could get an associate's degree, an AA degree, with their high school diploma. That way, our young people are ready for those 125,000 new jobs that are going to be available across the next 8 years that are going to require skilled labor. That's what part of the State of the State speech would look like.
And Mr. Walker, if you're elected governor, what will your State of the State address look like?
Well, it'll be exciting because Alaska will have made history. We're about to make history with the unity ticket, the nonpartisan. It'll be very exciting. But, you know, I will be forthright with Alaska in that State of the State. I will talk about the deficit we're in. If we're in a deficit, I'll talk about that. It's not a time to be, you know, I'm a very optimistic person, but Alaska needs to know where we are, that we're in the largest deficit we've been in. Of course, the pipeline will be the absolute highest priority. I will expedite that happening. There's no question about that. But it's certainly about the future. But if we step over where we are today, I don't think that's being completely honest with Alaska when we don't talk about our financial situation. That didn't happen last year. It will happen this year. But it will also talk about what we'll do as far as how we will get out of this, how we will build our way out of this deficit we're in. But if we don't talk about being in a deficit, We do things like the LIO office, where we increase the rent by 600% for legislative offices. You know, we spend on things that we should not be spending on. So I'll be forthright with Alaskans, but I'll also be very positive about how we get out of the situation. That's what we need. That's called leadership.
All right, I have one quick question. We have just a little bit of extra time. Mr. Walker, how do you intend to vote for the minimum wage ballot initiative?
I will vote yes on the minimum wage. I think it's long overdue for us to have an adjustment on the minimum wage, so I absolutely will vote yes on the minimum wage.
Mr. Parnell.
And I'll vote yes as well.
All right. This concludes Public Broadcasting's 2014 Debate for the State for Governor. Our thanks to Sean Parnell and to Bill Walker, as well as our panelists, Alexander Gutierrez and Ben Matheson. Thank you all so much for being here and participating. Join us tomorrow evening as Debate for the State continues. We will feature candidates for U.S. House at 7 p.m. and U.S. Senate at 8 p.m. Good night.